From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. What to eat in Tomorrowland? We'll head to Disney and find out today on the show. The Queen of Pie is here, not me, the real Queen of Pie. Eating snails, a lesson in escargot. Then how some Angelenos are breaking the fast during Ramadan. I'll teach you how to start an urban homestead, plus Jonathan Gold takes us to Koreatown. But first, let's see what's fresh and in season this week at the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We're visiting today with Ray Garcia, who is the chef at Fig Restaurant. Fig is just steps away from the Farmers Market at the Fairmount Hotel. And you're here, as always, Ray, shopping at the market, picking up great ingredients. And can you share with us what has inspired you today and teach us how to cook with it?
Sure, Laura. So today we're at the market. I'm looking at pluots. Stone fruit are great right now. We're kind of transitioning a little bit out of the peaches and plums, at least from Ron Cornelson. So we're getting from Ron Cornelson out of Reedley. Last week, he had some great flavor granadas. This week are dapple dandies. So they're a great pluot. I love this ingredient because it has a good balance between sugar and some acid to it, which is really important in your cooking, whether you're cooking at home or in a restaurant. So we take that to back to Fig, and we do a dish with it where we balance that the spicy, sugary, sweet, salty, all kinds of different components. We have a dapple dandy salad with copa picante, which is a slightly spiced, aged copa coming out of the shoulder. And then we just do a little bit of sage yogurt and then some great greens from Maggie's Farm.
Hey, can you explain and describe what a pluot is?
So a pluot is a stone fruit. It has a very thin, soft flesh. It is a hybrid. And it has this sweet, delicate fruit, you know, in the center, usually kind of like a yellowish, orangish fruit. It's great. They can be really delicate, but they can also stand up to some big flavors.
Yeah, and a pluot comes from the fact that it's part plum and part apricot. And in some of them, there's more plum, and some there's more apricot. So in this one, the dapple dandy, do you think it's more plummy or more apricotty?
I would definitely say the dapple dandy is more plummy.
And then it's also called a dapple dandy because it looks like a marble. It's almost like purple and red and brown and tan, and they're beautiful.
It's a gorgeous piece of fruit. I wish I had a picture right now that I could show everybody, but it's a beautiful piece of fruit.
And Ray, you're also going to be one of the chefs that's going to be at the Localicious, which is the big 30 Farmer, 30 Chef Gala celebrating 30 years at the Santa Monica Farmers Market. And that's going to be down at the Annenberg Beach House on Friday, September 16th. And who are you pairing with, and what are you making for that?
Well, we're excited to be part of that event. It's great. You know, the Farmers Market being here 30 years, we want to do whatever we can to support, you know, not only the Farmers Market, but all the great farmers that have come here through the years, the great farmers and the great chefs. So we'll be pairing with the Jean family from Harry's Berry. So we're excited. Molly and Rick Jean will be our partners. And we're still we're looking at their harvest and seeing what's going to be available in the next few weeks. And we plan to do something exciting, probably with either their tomatoes, strawberries, or green beans.
Oh, that'd be great. Okay, good. Yeah, Localicious, it's going to be September 16th. It's at the Annenberg Beach House. 30 chefs, 30 farmers, 30 years. And tickets are $125. And you can get them online. Call the Farmers Market or go to goodfoodfestivals.com. That was Ray Garcia from Fig Restaurants, located at the Fairmont Hotel. And Ray, he can walk here. He's blocks away. He comes here every week and has done a lot of great stuff for the farmers at the restaurant. Ron Cornelson is one of the farmers who sells pluots here at the Santa Monica Farmers Market. He also sells for his neighbor, Art Lang, up in Reedley. And Ron and Art both grow probably some of the best-tasting fruit we have in the market. And on every given day at Ron's stand, you'll see Ron's fruit on one side of the table, Honeycrisp, which is Art Lang, on the other side. And today, Ron, I notice you have one, two, three, about five different kinds of pluots, and you got some of Art's as well. So tell us what kind of pluots you have today, and maybe give us a little bit of a rundown on the different flavors.
Okay, I've got about five pluots today. I have a total, I think, of 14 pluots growing. There is several different tastes to them. Everyone has a different flavor. Most of them are sweet, and they're different colored. Some are ugly. The flavor grenade is shaped like sort of like an oblong hand grenade. And then they come in different sizes, but they all have a very, very sweet flavor to them.
Yeah, and Chef Ray was describing they're sweet with a little bit of tartness, just enough so they're not just too sickening sweet, that they just pair with a lot of great food.
The dapple dandies have that taste. It has on the outside, it has a little bit of a skin taste, a little bit of tartness, and the inside is sweeter. It's a real, real mellow pluot.
And how long are you going to have all these pluots? You said you have like 20 varieties?
I've got about 14 right now. And I'm going to have them for 2 to 3 more weeks.
Okay, so right now is the peak time to come and get these. And they are today. They are so incredibly delicious.
I have Emerald Butte coming up next. It'll probably be coming out next week. It's all green on the outside, but it's very, very sweet. Don't let the color deceive you.
Okay, and that's a good thing to know about pluots in general, is that it doesn't have to be red like a plum to be sweet. The green, the dapples, the purple hue, the red, the orange, all the colors, they're all fantastic. All right, well, from one who loves pluots to one who grows pluots, thank you so much for all the information. And it's just been a real treat to sample all these and eat them just out of hand. Thanks so much, Ron.
Oh, thank you very much.
That was Ron Cornelson, and he's a grower up in Reedley. He's got 14 kinds of pluots, and we can enjoy them only for the next few weeks. So come on down and try one of each. They're beautiful and delicious. The 30th anniversary of the Farmers Market is coming up, and we are going to be having 4 days of exciting programming events all around the city of Santa Monica, starting on the 14th of September with a wonderful chef demo here at the Wednesday Market with Amelia Salzman and friends, including Suzanne Goen. Thursday night, we're having a big opening plenary where we're going to have speakers, national speakers, meeting at Barnum Hall, which is a beautiful WPA-era art building. We're also going to be having a premiere of an art exhibit of WPA original art that was painted under the WPA in the 1930s by out-of-work artists. And we have several images that capture scenes of farms in Los Angeles. And be sure to sign up for the Localicious Gala that Rafe Garcia will be participating in. 30 chefs, 30 farmers celebrating 30 years at the Annenberg Community Beach House on Friday, September 16th. Hope to see you at all of our events. And for the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
A recipe for Chef Ray Garcia's Dapple Dandy Salad with Copa Picante and Sage Yogurt is on the Good Food blog. Disney World in Florida is a land unto itself. The sprawling theme park is larger than the island of Manhattan. It even boasts its own zip code. With over 200 restaurants on the property to choose from, deciding where to eat can be a real challenge. AJ Wolf, the voice behind the Disney food blogs, here to help. I asked AJ to explain the difference between eating at a restaurant in Disney World versus eating at a restaurant in her hometown of Dallas, Texas.
Well, to me, the difference is often in the theming of the restaurant. Pretty much every moderately priced restaurant in Disney World is themed to something, whether it's a certain country or a different type of music or a different type, just a movie or something like that. So they're all themed towards something. So it automatically takes you out of your regular life and it places you into an experience or something that you're not used to. So you're automatically on sensory overload. So the food is going to taste a little bit different, a little bit more exciting. You know, and the way that you're treated there, you also have some great service. You have really, really great cast members, which is what Disney calls its employees, who are putting on a quote-unquote show for you. And you're in a theme park and you're on vacation. So those things also contribute to you just feeling a little bit better that day than on a day you would have to go to work.
When you're there, well, first of all, how often do you go?
I am probably in Disney World and Disneyland an average of 4 times a year, maybe 5 times a year.
And each time you go, how many places do you taste?
I eat 3 meals a day, easy. So I probably will hit 20 restaurants in a visit.
And what have been the biggest changes that you've seen in terms of either the type of service or the kind of food highlighted on the menus in the past, let's say, 5 years?
That's a great question. There is a major move in the Disney parks and resorts towards healthier eating whenever possible. So at this point, you will see options on the menus that you might not have seen 10 and 20 years ago, more vegetarian dishes, more food that can be changed up so that it's healthier, more vegetables. Kids aren't automatically given soda pop and French fries anymore. Those actually have to be asked for. What they're given automatically is options like water, milk, juice, carrots, grapes, apples, applesauce, things like that that are a little bit on the healthier side that the kids like just as much, if not more, than they like the fries and the sodas. You also see a move towards being very, very careful with special diets, people who are who need to eat gluten-free, or people who are vegan, or people who, you know, are diabetic, you'll see lots more options for those folks in the parks these days.
So let's talk for a minute about the traditional amusement park food. I was just at the Orange County Fair last week and was reminded of all of the deep-fried Snickers and
food on a stick.
Yeah, food on a stick.
Right.
And I would imagine some of that still exists.
Absolutely. That's the great thing about Disney is whatever you want to eat, you can probably find there. They have a lot of variety. Because they are so big, they can cover so many different types of diets. If you want to eat cupcakes and chicken nuggets all day, you can absolutely do that. If you want to eat filet mignon, if you want to have an incredible wine experience, you can do that as well. So really, there's something for everybody there, and it's not that hard to find it.
Now, what about the cost of the food? When I think about it, it seems to me that it might be like being at an airport. You're captive, so it sort of is very expensive.
The cost is definitely high. I find that the amount that I will spend for food at Disney World is similar to what I'll spend in big cities around the world. So if I'm going to eat in New York or if I'm going to eat in London, it'll be similar to what I'm going to pay in Disney World a lot of the time. However, you can get some great food at some low prices. Generally, if you're going to go to one of those moderate restaurants, you're going to pay anywhere between $12 and $20 for a meal. If you're going to one of the upscale restaurants, you're going to pay between $30 all the way up to $200 plus for a meal. So there's wide variety of what you can get for the money there.
When I think of a place that has a huge population of the under 10 set, I think that there must be quite a sizable contingent of picky eaters. Are children more likely to eat something unfamiliar if there's Mickey Mouse on the plate?
You know, that's what we have found, and we, I mean, by our unscientific experiments that we've done, kids feel more comfortable in Disney World, and so therefore they'll often feel more adventurous in Disney World. So you might be able to get kids to eat something there that they wouldn't eat at home simply because they're surrounded by, you know, that Disney magic that they're experiencing. And I do think if Mickey's face is on it, it might have a little something to do with it. But unfortunately, you won't find too many Mickey's face imprinted vegetables at Disney World, but you may find a Mickey-shaped vegetable now and again.
So we've heard that at Universal Orlando, their new Harry Potter world is just an enormous success, and that one of the biggest successes there is the Butterbeer stand. Have you tried it yet?
I haven't been over to try the Butterbeer yet. I haven't been able to wrench my way away from Disney World to get over there. But basically, people say it's kind of like a very buttery, very butterscotchy cream soda.
I heard that the line for the Butterbeer was 4 hours long.
That's what I heard. I think the line for the Butterbeer has been longer than the line for the actual ride there.
So interesting. Well, we're delighted to have had you here on Good Food. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, too. I appreciate it.
That was AJ Wolf. AJ writes the Disney Food Blog, a guide to eating at restaurants in Disney World and Disneyland. We'll have a link at kcrw.com/goodfood. Speaking of restaurant recommendations, it's time now for a visit from Jonathan Gold. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Weekly, and he joins me here every week with a restaurant recommendation. This week, we're headed to, surprise, Koreatown.
The name of the restaurant is Palsek. It's on Western in one of those interminable mini malls, like behind the Madanguksu, which is the good guksu place. Koreatown seems to be very pork-oriented. I mean, it seems like when you drive the streets of Koreatown, you see cartoon pigs on like one new restaurant out of two. And this is one of them.
And is it a particular part of the animal that seems to achieve star status in the dishes?
Probably the most popular pork dish in Korean restaurants is samgyeopsal, which is to say pork belly that's grilled on a special grill and then wrapped up, if you like, in leaves with all kinds of condiments. And this restaurant, I think, is the only one that serves only pork belly. The interesting thing that I found out when I was doing some reading is that pork belly is actually considered health food in Korea. that it's supposed to be good for the complexion, and the fats in pork belly are supposed to be the good kind of fats that make you just glow with health. I must say this restaurant, which is, as far as I can tell, a branch of probably the most famous Samgyeopsal restaurant in Seoul, plays up the health food aspect. You don't just order pork belly, though you could. You order their combination, which I think they translate as eight colorful flavors of pork.
Eight colorful flavors of pork. So is the pork belly prepared in eight different ways, or are there eight different colorful adjuncts to the pork belly?
There are eight different marinades. I mean, beginning with, like, no marinade at all, and, you know, a ginseng, one with wine and herbs that's nice, a curry one, one with a miso paste, a really nice one with Korean, you know, chili paste, gochujang.
My favorite.
And you look at the menus and you look at the walls and it tells you the health benefits of all of them. And it's nice to know that garlic lowers cholesterol and high blood pressure, but I'm not sure that really applies when you're marinating pork belly in it.
So when you're eating the pork belly, is it akin to eating other Korean barbecue cuts of meat? Is it sliced thin and then grilled in small slices so it gets nice and crispy all over? Or is it grilled in a strip and then sliced down so the inside is more tender and yielding?
The pork belly preparation here, which is tabletop, is very specific to this place. They have a slabby sort of iron grill that's slanted, so all the fat runs down into a canister that's set into the table. That it comes in this special tray, I think maybe even numbered 1 to 8, with the pork bellies in the order that you're supposed to eat them. They're thick slices of pork belly that they put down. And I think after you flip it and you think it's pretty much done, that's the point where you take out the scissors and go ch-ch-ch-ch-ch and cut it into the manageable slices.
It sounds delicious.
It's really good.
Which was your favorite special colorful version?
I kept gravitating back to the one with the pepper paste, the gochujang, because, you know, chili, slightly blackened, you know, pork belly. How could you go wrong? You take one of those sesame leaves, they call it sometimes gainip, and you put a piece of pork belly in and maybe a sliver of raw garlic, maybe a jalapeno, definitely a little bit of bean paste. And you roll it up into like a little package and then you eat it. So there's a lot of vegetables that are going down along with the pork belly.
And what's the price point of this?
One of these, I guess, set dinners, which comes with this and which comes with a really delicious seafood soup. They put a ton of greens in it and it simmers and the greens simmer down in the course of your meal. And then you eat it communally out of the communal bowl, you know, and including the banchan, is, I think, about $40. And four people could eat it. Three people is probably more realistic.
If we go to this restaurant, is there something else on the menu that we should try as well?
There are a couple other things on the menu. I've actually seen people order them, but I haven't tasted them myself. It would seem very much besides the point to go there and get anything other than pork belly.
Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Thank you.
I've been talking to Jonathan Gold of the LA Weekly about Palsak Korean Barbecue on Western between 8th and 9th in Koreatown. Get the exact address sent to your cell phone in a very convenient text message. All you have to do is text the words good food to the number 69866. That's good food to the number 69866. And, of course, you can see all of Jonathan's restaurant suggestions on our Good Food restaurant map, which is on the Good Food blog. Next up, a visit from the Queen of Pie. Stay tuned. You're listening to KCRW and KCRW.com. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. There is a goddess of pie, and her name is Rose Levy Barenbaum. Her book, The Pie and Pastry Bible, is aptly named. If there's any part of pie making that you ever wanted to learn, you'll find it in her book. But even Rose wasn't born knowing how to make a great pie. She's had her share of spectacular failures, too. I asked Rose to share with us her stories and give us some of her tips. So, Rose, spectacular failures. Share some with us.
Oh, I don't even have to think twice to remember the first one. It was when I was 17. It was a lemon meringue pie. And it really wasn't my fault, but, you know, failures don't necessarily have to be blamed on the person who's doing it. It was the water. I was making lemon meringue pie, and it wouldn't thicken. And I kept adding cornstarch until it was 3/4 of the box. And then I thought, this is Vermont and New England. And I didn't know anything about hard water, but I thought, you know, the rice is always very sticky, and maybe something's going on here. So I had the water tested. On a scale of 1 to 10, it was 10. It was probably 11. And cornstarch apparently won't thicken correctly if the water's too hard. So I thought, okay, there's more to this than meets the eye. I don't think I made lemon meringue pie for several years after. I was so traumatized by it. And the sad thing is that nobody had any money, so 4 students contributed to the ingredients of this lemon meringue pie.
Share with us your pumpkin pie story, because I love that one.
Thank you. I guess that would be my next traumatic experience. No, there was the cherry pie in between. But that was sort of leading up to the pumpkin pie, because the cherry pie, I used Comstock filling, so I assumed that pie filling, I'm ashamed to admit this, but I assumed that pie filling was pie filling. So when my former husband, who was a Vermonter and loved pumpkin pie, asked me to make that, I said, well, okay, to myself, I'll just go get pumpkin pie filling. But I wasn't looking for something saying filling, so what I ended up with was just pumpkin. And I put it into the pie shell, and I served it to him, and I took a taste, and I thought, it tasted like a barnyard. I said, how can you eat this? And he said, I can't. What did you put in there? And I said, well, I put pumpkin. And he said, what else? And I said, well, what else do you need to put in? You know, I thought that was a complete filling. He looked at me like I was a moron.
So this morning we were talking a little bit, and you mentioned that you had a few tips that you wanted to share.
Yeah, because, you know, the best pies really, or most of the best pies, are the fruit pies of summer. And that's when it's hardest to make a crust, because you need it to be cool. So what I recommend doing is you can do pie crust a day ahead. It's all the better. It gives it a chance to relax. You can chill it. You don't have to, but if you're planning to do it the same day, I would get up early in the morning in the cool hours of the morning and then make sure the surface is cool. But another big thing is I like to use either pastry flour for most things or bleached all-purpose. If you use more like a cake flour or not a national brand all-purpose, it won't have enough protein and it will fall apart. That's another story that happened to me on television on the West Coast when, years ago, they gave me the wrong type of flour. They prepared the pie crust and it broke into 3 pieces. It was, Safeway, because I remember thinking of it as Unsafeway after that. You know, regional flours vary in their protein content. So if you use Gold Medal, Pillsbury, anything that you can get anywhere, you're good to go.
Thank you, Rose.
Oh, you're so welcome.
That was Rose Levy Barenbaum. Her book, The Pie and Pastry Bible, is a truly incredible resource for both master bakers and pie novices. Whether you've made 1,000 pies or only one, I encourage you to enter the 3rd annual Good Food Pie Contest happening on Sunday, September 18th at LACMA. It's more than just a contest. It's a community event. This year, we have 5 categories: fruit, cream, nut, savory, and Tim Burton-inspired pie. You can enter in just one category or try your hand at all 5. Details on how to enter the contest are at kcrw.com/pie. I'm also happy to announce 2 new faces at the pie contest judging table this year. Aida Mollenkamp, host of Cooking Channel's Ask Aida and Food Crafters, and Leslie Bala of Chowbala.com will join Jonathan Gold, Sang Yoon, and other A-list chefs and food writers at the judges' table. But now you have a chance to join them, too. Tell me about the pie experience that changed your life in 500 words or less. Submit your essay on my Facebook page or email it to me at goodfood@kcrw.com. On September 3rd, I'll pick a winner, hold Be a Judge at the Good Food Pie Contest. You'll get to sit next to Jonathan Gold. Full details about the essay contest are on the Good Food blog. This week marks the final week of the holy month of Ramadan, the ninth month on the Islamic calendar when participating Muslims fast during daylight hours. All across Los Angeles, people are breaking the fast in a variety of ways, from home-cooked meals to dinner at Denny's. We caught up with the Muslim youth group of the Islamic Center of Southern California as they broke the fast.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar, Allah.
Hello, my name is Wasi Momin. I'm 15 years old, and I'm the spiritual and educational director at the Muslim youth group of the Islamic Center of Southern California. I started fasting like whole days and continuously around the time of 10 or 11, perhaps, and I fasted the last two Ramadans. But first, it's getting used to the no food, no water, getting up at 4 or 5 to have that meal. But you get used to it, and it's a type of spiritual exercise that I guess, and it really helps because I feel that I'm a better person each Ramadan that I go through. It really disciplines me, teaches me many things.
Hi, my name is Soha Yassin. I'm the Youth and Volunteer Coordinator at the Islamic Center of Southern California. Ramadan is as much about spirituality as it is about community building. The way that Muslims traditionally break their fast is over a date, and that's because it's been narrated from the Prophet that it is ideal to break your fast with a date. I've also read so many articles about the benefits of dates as rehydrating you and providing those who haven't had water with the proper nutrients. So you'll find dates at the center of any iftar table, iftar being the meal of breaking the fast. As important as the iftar is the suhoor meal. And for many, suhoor is more important than iftar because after a long day of not eating or drinking, it's difficult to eat a full nutritious meal when your stomach has shrunk so little. And so many Muslims will opt to have a second and sometimes even a third meal before the dawn. The meal that happens right before dawn is called suhoor. And you'll find Muslims have their suhoor meals at home with their families. You'll find Denny's and IHOPs become very crowded with Muslims around the 3 o'clock hour. So over the years, because Ramadan has been taking place in the summertime, there's been this like emergence of suhoor parties because many young people aren't in school and they have summer off. And so people get together at 11 p.m., midnight, to eat, socialize, you know, catch up with one another and share the suhoor meal. So it's really nice because we get to fulfill that spiritual aspect, but then also at the end of the night, get together and share a meal.
One of the great things about the month of Ramadan are the community breakfast meals or the iftar meals. And a great thing about being Muslim in America is that there are Muslims from all over the world, so we get the chance to taste food from India and Pakistan, from Indonesia and Malaysia and Bangladesh, from from Iran, from Turkey, from the Arab world, North Africa. So we might have couscous one night. We might have soup, which is traditionally served in Iran, for example. And then certain dishes and certain desserts are traditionally served during this month in the Syria, Palestine, Jordan, Lebanon region. They serve something called fatayr, which is like a pancake folded in half with cinnamon and walnuts or pistachios, or sometimes cheese, and then it's deep fried. So it's really delicious. I guess it's like the Muslim version of the deep fried Twinkie. Delicious, delicious food during this month.
Good food producer Laurel Garcia produced that segment. We'll have photos of breaking the fast on the Good Food website. Share your photos on my Facebook page. Search for me, Evan Kleiman, as a page, and click like. Coming up, why more women are becoming farmers, and would you like a full-bodied cab with your Big Mac? We'll pair wine with fast food. That's coming up here on 89.9 KCRW and KCRW.com.
Thank you.
Farming is hard work. The days are long, and the labor itself can be backbreaking. Now, imagine a farming system in which farmers are also the victims of racial discrimination and government injustice. That's exactly what happened to a group of African-American farmers in the American South. Here to tell us about it is Oren Hesterman, president and CEO of Fair Food Network. For 15 years, Oren co-led the Integrated Farming Systems and Food and Society programs for the Kellogg Foundation. His book, Fair Food, is an articulate and clear look at our broken food system. You mentioned that African-American farmers in the South, even today, are having trouble maintaining access to and ownership of farmland. Could you describe the kind of decline there's been in black farmers?
Certainly. It's really been a devastating decline in the ownership of farms and farmland by black farmers. You know, in 1920, there were almost a million farms in the United States, most of them in the South, owned and operated by blacks. By 2007, which is our last census of agriculture, that had declined to about 30,000 farms, a 97% decline since 1920. Now, we know that there's been a decline in number of farms and farm ownership overall, but the disparity between the decline in farm ownership overall and the decline in farm ownership among blacks and African Americans, is that disparity is huge.
Is it part of the situation where we've seen a decline in small farms across the board? Did African-American farms tend to be more medium and small-sized rather than large?
Farms owned by blacks have always been somewhat smaller than in acreage. But if you start looking into the reasons for this, the reasons are primarily, and it's been admitted by the USDA, the reasons are primarily have to do with structural racism in the system, that initially, the kind of racism that when, after the Civil War, when blacks were allowed to start owning their own land, the sort of social and economic system in local communities rendered the worst farmland, the most marginal land, the land farthest away from resources like irrigation water and rail lines, to the African Americans, and the best land to the whites. So there's some sort of structural racism socially and economically. But it really got exacerbated as our farms became more and more dependent on government resources, especially for operating loans, where Farmers Home Administration, established in 1946, was to be the lender of last resort for farmers in this country. So any farmer who couldn't get a loan anywhere else, they could always come to the Farmers Home Administration to get money to buy their seed, their fertilizer, their equipment to get started in the spring. Because after all, if you're a farmer, you got a lot of expense up front in the spring, and you're not going to get your money till you sell your crops in the fall. Well, the African Americans were systematically denied access to those kinds of operating loans and the kind of technical assistance that USDA was supposed to be providing them. And finally, when Dan Glickman was our Secretary of Agriculture under President Clinton, a lawsuit was finally won called Pigford versus Glickman. And it was a class action suit where the USDA, the federal government, admitted, yes, we have had structural racism involved in our system. We have been systematically denying African Americans the same rights to our federal resources that they should be getting. And so there have been payments available and being made to some farmers who had been involved in this.
And the loss of those farms must have had a tremendous impact on the increase in rural poverty.
Well, you can look at these areas in the country like the Mississippi Delta and some of the most persistent poverty in the country. So absolutely, it's affected every family that has ties to farmland in the South.
When rural communities are so at risk and are so behind because they've experienced this structural racism for so many years, are they more vulnerable to land grabs?
Well, what happens is, if any farmer that can't make a living on their land, there's going to be a vulnerability to that land being lost one way or another. And whether it's somebody coming in and buying the land on speculation for future agriculture, or whether it's an area that is close to an expanding population and we're losing that farmland to urban or suburban sprawl. It's a real issue.
What do you see as a solution for bringing more young farmers, farmers of color, and those in communities that have farmland but haven't had economic entree to do anything with that land?
Here's the good news. You know, there's a lot of bad news in what we've been talking about, but I really believe that there's really good news happening because so many people are waking up to this issue of a food system, and not just waking up to be making sure they are feeding themselves and their families healthier food. That's a certainly important and a good start. But what I say is we have to move beyond the refrigerator. We have to move beyond thinking we're going to change the system solely by what we individually put into our refrigerator or take out of it. That these are issues that are systemic, and we have to be engaged citizens as well as conscious consumers. But some of the good news is that when we look at the last agricultural census in 2007, the increase in principal farm operators and owners among Hispanics, among women, and among blacks have all increased in the 5 years leading up to the last agricultural census. In fact, women as principal operators have increased by 30%. Now, what are all the reasons for this? It's hard to know. But I believe part of it is that there are new business opportunities as farmers that people are seeing as we are able to support more small and mid-sized farm operations through farmers markets, through CSAs, through farm-to-school efforts, through universities and colleges procuring more locally grown and sustainable food. It's creating all kinds of opportunities that we see people starting to take advantage of.
I'd love to talk about water for a minute and access that communities of need have to ownership of water and how that impacts farming.
I believe this is going to become the issue of our day. I mean, we'll talk about some specifics in a minute, but if we think in terms of, for example, the Ogallala Aquifer, one of the largest aquifers in the world, so it sits underneath eight states between South Dakota and Texas. And it's just this huge sort of underground lake that was developed over geological times, and it's being pumped out at about 18 times the rate that it can be replenished. And no matter what expert you talk to or read, sometime within 15 to 50 years, it's going to be drained. And that one aquifer is responsible for several billions of dollars of agricultural output. And we are going to find millions of acres either having to shift to production of drought-tolerant crops, or in the worst case, it's going to become desert.
This is a conversation that could go on for hours. I thank you so much for the time you've given us.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
That was Orrin Hesterman. His book, Fair Food, envisions a healthy, sustainable food system for all. Ever wish you could bring a bottle of two-buck chuck to McDonald's? I think perhaps more than a few eyebrows would be raised if you walked in with a bottle, but you can actually pair wine with fast foods at home. Gregory Dalpiaz is editor-in-chief of Snooth.com, a web-based social shopping experience that simplifies how people purchase their favorite wines. So let's start with McDonald's, of course. Did you sort of think in your mind, did you choose a wine and then find a food that would pair, or did you start with the food?
Well, actually, I started with the wines, but the wine recommendations I'm making are not really for the specific wines. I'm pairing two sort of genres, and it's pretty easy to divide wines into a handful of genres. So I didn't want to get too specific because I don't think people really think about wines either specifically or in very narrow categories. They know they like a fruity red wine or a dry red wine. So I started by just finding a couple of bottles that I had lying around the office that seemed to fit. They seemed to sort of be the kind of wines that you might pair with McDonald's. They're readily available on a national scale. They're affordable. They're simple in a certain way, but that's what makes them work well with McDonald's. And then I think we bought everything off the menu at McDonald's.
So take me through the pairing. What did you buy and what did you drink with it?
Basically, whatever we bought, I tried with each wine. So I believe there were 7 wines for the McDonald's pairing, and I sat down and tried the Chicken McNuggets with all 7 wines, the Big Mac with all 7 wines, the Chicken BLT sandwich with all 7 wines. The interesting thing to me was that while the success rate wasn't that high, it wasn't any lower than with regular restaurant-prepared meals, but that there were some significant and interesting pairings. The best one was a lightly wooded South African Chenin Blanc, which actually paired spectacularly well with the Chicken BLT sandwich. They both have a smoky character. The acidity and the richness of the Chenin Blanc match the fat and the richness, I guess, of the chicken sandwich. So that was the most memorable pairing from that exercise.
Do you want to share a brand that exemplifies this kind of wine?
I would have to say that Valley of the Moon out of Sonoma County has been putting together some really impressive wines at a very affordable price point that are easy and accessible and fun to drink. And I think that's a brand that sort of epitomizes the kind of wines that would pair well with a wide variety of foods.
Now, I didn't ask you, but did you actually do these tastings at McDonald's, or did you bring things home?
No, we brought all the food to the office. I think that they would have been probably horrified to see somebody sitting there for 2 hours tasting their food, drinking wine, and of course I swallow the food, but I spit out the wine. Otherwise, the end of the exercise would be much less efficient than the beginning of the exercise, and it's just not a pretty sight.
Okay, so let's move from McDonald's and go to KFC, which is chicken. I mean, how hard is chicken to pair?
It's definitely not hard to pair. I mean, it's actually one of the easiest things to pair. It seems to like lots of different wines. Of course, there's the fried chicken, which has more grease, more fat, which requires more acid from a wine. And then, of course, there's their new grilled chicken, both of which have the secret blend of herbs and spices. And really what we were trying to pair was the herbs and spices. So the real exercise there, I think, was how much acid and how much sugar should be in a wine to pair well with KFC. So we did try one red wine, which didn't work. I didn't think it was going to work. But we assembled a lineup of white wines that ran through the spectrum from very dry, very high acid, to a little bit of sugar, still high acid, a little bit of sugar, lower acid, and then some lightly oaked wines. I think a lot of fast food has a sweeter edge to it. I think it's a very popular flavor profile. And in order to sort of match that, there are two ways that food and wine work well together. You can either contrast the flavors and the textures, or you can complement the flavors and the textures. And I found, in particular with the KFC, it was interesting to me, actually, complementing worked much better.
So now let's jump to Chipotle, which when I think of Chipotle, I think of pork. And I think pork would be pretty easy to pair, yet it has all that Mexican flavor. Does that make it more difficult?
It makes it infinitely more difficult. One of the big issues I had, a lot of feedback for the Chipotle article, came from people who said, and I explicitly stated this in the article, how can you eat Chipotle without the sauces? And I believe they have 5 different sauces. And I couldn't figure out how to taste every dish with 5 different sauces. And then, of course, some people use a little bit of sauce. I tend to be a condiment abuser. So there's a whole range of permutations that you could introduce there. So I ended up tasting all of Chipotle's food without the sauce, but it still has salsa and sour cream and guacamole. It has all those exciting flavors and textures that make a Mexican or Tex-Mex food so fun to eat. So it certainly was a challenge. The interesting thing to me was one of the best dishes to pair with food happened to be Chipotle's vegetarian burrito, which took out what we would assume to be the simple to pair with wine element and left everything else in there.
And was there one particular wine that just seemed to go, sort of the only wine that went well with everything?
Yes, the Kenwood Chardonnay. And it's interesting because once again, we're faced with a really mainstream product. that's has proven to be very popular, and it's popular for a reason. Again, it goes well with the with what people eat, but it really matches people's palate preferences. It has the richness to pair up against guacamole and sour cream. It had the acidity to cut through the salsa, which has tomatoes and onions, high acid elements. And it's a fairly simple, once again, fruity wine. And when I say simple, I'm just really being technically honest. It's not a derogatory term in my book. I love simple wines. I love wines that sometimes you don't have to think about. You just can enjoy.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
That was Gregory Del Piaz. Gregory is the editor-in-chief of Snooth.com. We'll have a link to Gregory's articles about pairing wine with fast food at our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. I want to take a second to thank everyone who joined or renewed their membership during KCRW's summer membership drive. If you didn't get a chance to join, there is still time. Join KCRW as a $10 monthly member, and you'll be invited to a free dinner hosted by me at Loteria Grill in Hollywood. Chef Jimmy Shaw and I will be cooking up a Mex-Italian feast with dishes like gnocchi with poblano chiles and huitlacoche lasagna. Go to kcrw.com/join and become a monthly member. Be sure to put the words good food in the comment section of the online form. The offer is good until September 13th. Next up, how to start an urban homestead. That's after this short break. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be right back. This is Good Food from KCRW and KCRW.com. The DIY movement seems to be gaining strength at an exponential rate. More and more people are ripping up their backyards, installing raised beds, and constructing chicken coops in any available space. Rachel Kaplan's the co-author of the book Urban Homesteading, Heirloom Skills for Sustainable Living. She comes from a family of bi-coastal farmers and has been gardening for more than 15 years. She's here today to give us some tips on starting an urban homestead. Rachel, I guess my first question would be, what is the difference between just somebody's regular home and an urban homestead?
Well, in my estimation, an urban homestead is a place where the people who live in it are trying to move from being simply consumers to being producers of things like food and energy and generating excellent neighborhood relationships and really trying to manage some of the essential pieces of life that we've given away to our consumer culture.
So in order to do this, in order to become producers of what we need to live, at least on a continuum, do you need a large amount of land?
You definitely do not. We talk to a lot of different homesteaders who are working in very small spaces to like 2,000 square feet total of their house and their quote-unquote land to people who have larger spaces. You can grow a lot of food in barrels and different containers. And one of the things in the city is that you can get involved in community-based projects where you can start producing some of the things you need, community gardens or converting abandoned lots into gardens.
Describe the homestead that you and your co-author Ruby have set up.
Both she and I are fairly diverse in what we do. Ruby has a gray water system and I think some rainwater catchment. We both have outdoor composting toilets. We both grow as much as we can, extensive growing. We have different animals, rabbits. She has rabbits and quail. We keep chickens. My partner's a beekeeper and she's a beekeeper. So we're doing a lot of the small animal husbandry. She works in a goat keeping collective in Oakland. There's a ton of goats wandering through the streets of Oakland. And so she's gotten invited and invested in working with the goats.
Now, you mentioned that you have an outdoor composting toilet. Describe that system for us.
Well, I have a very rudimentary one where I bought a medical toilet seat and I have two buckets. One is for pee and one is for poo. And in the pee, I just put straw in it and I make my deposits. And then the straw gets infiltrated with the urine. And when it's full, I dump the whole thing onto my compost pile. Urine is sterile and high in nitrogen. And so it's an excellent addition to a compost bin and helps create really highly nutritive compost. With the poop, I have another bucket, which has inside of it a container from a plant, which has at the bottom of it some soil, which has worms in it. And so then I make my deposits there. And after each one, I add some carbon matter, either sawdust or straw, until that one is totally full. And then I top it off with more compost with worms. And then I take that inner bucket and I leave it to sit under a tree to fully compost down for about 3 months. Then it's mostly soil and I plant things in it.
Do you plant edible things in it or only ornamental things?
Well, the thing about that compost is once it has composted, it is safe to use in the garden. But I would never plant something like a beet or a carrot in something like that because I wouldn't want to risk any kind of contamination.
Do you only grow things to eat or do you have plant matter that's used for other things?
I grow many things for eating. I also grow things that are just sheerly for beauty because I think beauty is extremely important. And I grow different plants that have medicinal value, and some plants I grow, which are medicinal, like comfrey, I actually grow because the leaves are a really excellent addition to the compost. So they're what we call mulch producer.
Tell me a little bit about the medicinal herbs.
Well, I really love growing herbs that you can turn into medicine. I find it to be an incredible process. There's many of them that we can grow. Some of the simple ones that are really easy to propagate and continue in the garden are calendula or lavender or yarrow or mugwort. Many of them are self-seeding, so even though they're annuals, they come back year after year. They're very beautiful. They often provide pollination for bees, which is also a great thing to do in urban settings. And then the processes of turning herbs into medicine is very simple. Making a tincture or making a salve is, it takes some weeks, but to tincture an herb, you take the part of the plant that you want to use and you steep it in a high-proof vodka for about 6 weeks in your closet, and then you decant it afterwards and you have a tincture. You can do this with lots of different herbs that you see that you get in the stores. You can do it with osha or echinacea, comfrey, calendula. And salves are also very simple. It's just combining beeswax and these tinctures and heating them up, combining them, and then letting them cool down.
Let's say we want to start. What is the first project that we can do on a fairly limited budget? Something that goes beyond just planting tomatoes, let's say.
Just taking on the simple action of taking your kitchen scraps and all the organic materials that come from your backyard and creating a compost bin is a great way to get started. I think small animals, if you have the space, are also a really sweet way to get connected also to the other creatures that live around us. Rabbits are very simple, and if you are going to have a garden, they create the single best fertilizer, and they're simple to care for, and children love them, so you can bring your children into the project. Quail are also really simple. They give eggs after they're like 6 or 7 weeks old.
Well, thank you so much, Rachel. It's been a great conversation.
Thank you so much.
Rachel Kaplan is an urban homesteader living in Sonoma County. She co-authored the book Urban Homesteading, Heirloom Skills for Sustainable Living. If you have an urban homestead or even a small edible garden, you've probably come across snails. A nightmare in the garden, they can be a delicacy on the plate. Today, D-Ben diner Eddie Lynn visits the kitchen at L'Épicerie in Culver City for a lesson on preparing escargot.
So Chef Sebastian Archambault is going to walk me through step-by-step escargot à la Périgordine.
So you put your butter on the pan. Just is melting a little bit brown. You add your prosciutto. Dice your shallots. Dice two very thin. And you cook like that 30 seconds until it gets a little bit softer. and the flavor go out. So now I put the snails, and as we plate it directly, I put the potatoes with that at the same time. So we'll have the potatoes. I put the white wine, some salt, and we reduce it until it's dry. So now, as you can start to hear, the wine is getting dry and the butter is starting to go back. We can put some fresh chopped garlic on it and a little bit of fresh chopped parsley too. And we can add our chicken jus, just a little bit. Now, the spinach. Just 15 seconds. Ready. So now we can plate. We start by the baby spinach. On top of that, we put the baby potatoes. This heirloom, this is a very nice potatoes. They are very nice potatoes. Very nice color, very nice size. And you put your escargot on the center. And after you finish your plate by putting your sauce a little bit around and your prosciutto on top. Et voilà, it's ready to eat.
That's the best plate of snails I've ever seen in my life.
Thank you.
This is Eddie Lin in Culver City coming to you from La Pisserie Market for Good Food.
An escargot recipe is at kcrw.com/goodfood. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. Good Food is also available on demand on KCRW's apps for the iPod, Android, and BlackBerry. And don't forget to download our special bonus podcast, The Podcast. Good Food is produced by Jillian Ferguson. Lara Garcia and Candace Moyer are our segment producers. The executive producer is Harriet Ells. Thanks to Ronnie Mickelson, Gary Messiha, Becky Nelson, and Becky Gebhardt. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll see you back here next week for another edition of Good Food.